Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
There is a tree that lurks in the dark. A tree that sees the darkness, that knows just how long the night lasts. It's watching. All through the day, it seems to stand vigil, motionless, but for the breeze. Yet like a gargoyle arching over its domain, its eyes ever staring outwards, the tree's leaves watch for dusk, knowing that night will soon follow. All through the night, it watches still, scanning the horizon, knowing that the long night was over. It prowls the prairies and savannas and the dark forests, thorns bristling from its trunk, so sharp even a shrike shrieks and doesn't dare come near, its larder of impaled vermin kept on a less fearsome tree. It's searching for giant bears nearly twice the size of a grizzly, mammoths with mighty tusks 16 feet long, for gomphotheres, giant elephant-like beasts with spears jutting from below their fierce jaws, searching for sloths the size of a 2012 Ford Fiesta. But it will never find them, because they are all dead.
Wow!
No one knows who killed them. All we have today are their bones lying placidly beneath the crawling roots of the trees. We can't help but notice, though, the trees looming above, casting dagger shadows across their dusty graves with its steely spines. From its tawny twigs, bent and knuckled, dangling succulent fruit, as if enticing you to come closer, closer. A siren song beckoning you to climb its limbs, as if sweetly serenading you. Climb my limbs, my dear sweet friend. They won't break, just merely bend. My sweet seeds await for you aloft. Against your cheeks my leaves feel soft. Fear you not a pesky spine, let me move them up you climb. Once you're here you'll get a taste, and forever in my limbs we shall embrace. It may be along your street, Alex. It may be in your local park. It may be in your backyard right now. Because the tree we're talking about today is the honey locust.
A nice big simple rhyme to end it.
whoa. No, I didn't rhyme. The last one didn't rhyme.
I know that, Casey.
Thanks, Alex.
That was incredible, Case.
I wrote that in like an hour getting ready to do the episode like a while back. I was going to do it, and then you're like, hey, can we actually meet at 12 to do the recording? And I was like, yes.
Wow.
I know just what I'm going to spend the next hour doing.
That's right.
And I wrote that because, Alex, this tree is scary.
Stunning, Casey. What's up, Fungal Associates? Welcome to Completely Arbitrary, a podcast about trees and other related topics. The spooky season has begun.
That's right.
It's our spooky Fortnite series, and we're not talking about the video game.
Mm-mm.
Talking about the meaning of the season.
2 weeks. Two weeks worth of time.
That's right. I am Alex Croson.
I am Casey Clapp. Yeah. Oh, God. I got to turn this light on, Alex. I'm petrified over here.
Future published Jesus. Author, Casey Clapp.
Whoa, you think so? Wow.
Well, I know so, Casey. Oh,
that is true. I do have a book. I have a book deal.
Yes.
How exciting.
Whoa, it has happened.
Way to bring that up.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to be writing a tree ID book here in the Pacific Northwest. And the honey locust is going to be included in it, just to be clear.
A stunning way to open these next 2 weeks of episodes, Casey.
Do you got goosebumps?
Yes.
Yeah, me too. Good. What about you out there, everyone? I hope someone just turned the lights on because, like, oh my God, it's right there. And they look out the window and they see this honey locust.
Tap, tap, tapping at your chamber window.
I am very proud of that. So thank you for the response, Alex.
Yeah, it was great, Casey.
Because I gave so many very accurate, scary things for this tree. I myself am like, good job, Casey.
Yeah, that could be like our new thing where you just give like a little poem in the beginning.
And always make sure that I reference the size of something based around a 2012 Ford Fiesta.
Absolutely. And that way people don't have to listen to the rest of the episode. If they're in a time crunch, they can just listen to Casey's thoughts in the beginning.
Casey's prose slash poetry.
The musings of a madman.
Oh, yeah, that's called completely arbitrary.
Hi, Case.
Good day, Alex.
Good day. Hey, speaking of response, we have something that maybe we can bring this up later. This might be a little like a bit of a bowl in a china shop pivot to this topic.
All right, sure.
But we have a listener survey that we need people to take.
Oh yeah, we do. Yeah, we should put that out here, right here.
You're let's
right.
Let's do it.
Everyone.
Everybody, Fungal Associates, we have a listener survey for you to take if you're willing. We are making some moves behind the scenes here.
Again.
But this time we swear it'll be great.
We promise. We won't do it again.
So we are moving to a new advertising agency.
That's right. A new platform entirely, actually.
Yeah, that's true. And we feel very well taken care of with these people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're great. We love them. Gumball.
Yeah. Anything that you've heard us talk about before, forget about it.
Yeah. Forget about it. This is Arbitrary 2.0. Well, one thing that comes along with this, Casey, is that we need to know a little bit more about our audience.
Yes.
In order to best deliver them advertisements. Now, that sounds very soulless and corporate.
It does.
But it is just a reality of making free content that we need to get paid somehow. And this is one of the ways we can do it.
Exactly. Yes. So the reality is we do have to have ads, mm-hmm. but we want to make them as less shitty as possible.
Right.
So this is how we're going about it. And in order to do that, having this survey is very helpful. That way we can provide this information all anonymous our partners, and they can say, great, cool, we do want to target these people because we think we have a product that they would like.
Yes.
So,
and if you want to take that listener survey and help out the pod in a free, very quick way, you can go to gum.fm/trees. That's gum.fm/trees.
That's right. You can also find it all over the place. We'll have it out there for a couple weeks. So
yeah, I took it myself because I am, after all, my own biggest fan.
Yes, we know this.
And it took about, I would say, a minute and a half to fill out, and it was
pretty quick.
It was not obtrusive. It didn't ask me anything that I was uncomfortable answering. And it was very straightforward, and it's all anonymous anyway, so they're not going to be using this to send you shit in the mail.
No.
So we have a lot of shakeups coming up, but Casey, one thing we're not shaking up is the fact that we are talking about a tree this episode.
That's right.
And as you have alluded, not even alluded, just said, we're talking about the honey locust today.
Mm-hmm.
Scientific name?
Scientific name, Gleditsia triacanthos.
You say that with such casual arrogance, just knowing that I'm going to say what?
I could have just walked over and been like, dropped $100 bill on you and then walked away.
Say it again?
It is Gleditsia triacanthos.
Gleditsia triacanthos.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
I learned that it's actually named after a guy called Johann Gottlieb Gleditsch.
Ah.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say John Gleditsia Caradanthos.
They just switched a little bit. No, not quite.
Well, see, I was trying to say the exact thing and I just couldn't remember.
You did a really good job.
I was suggesting that his last name is just the entire scientific name.
It's named after John Triacanthos. I see. All right.
That's right, Casey. We're talking about honey locust, and I'm very excited to learn about this tree. It's been on our short list for roughly 3 years, mm-hmm. and we're mm-hmm. finally getting to it in this, our fortnight of spooky episodes.
That's right.
And today we are talking the Sixth Sense.
Be afraid.
Wow.
Be very afraid.
Hi, everybody. Or should I say, hola a todos. I want you to hear something. It's this. Yes, that is the sound of learning a new language with Babbel. You have, of course, heard of Babbel. You maybe even used Babbel. But if you haven't, Babbel is an app that helps you learn languages. Babbel is a science-backed learning language app that actually works. Let me put it this way. I knew somebody who used a different language app for 365 days and still could not even have basic conversations in the language they were learning on that app. Babbel is not this. They have quick 10-minute lessons and they're handcrafted by 200 language experts, so you can start learning a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Because it's designed by real people for real conversations. In fact, a recent study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. And of course, the best way to learn a new language is immersion. You go and live in the place where the people speak the language you're learning. You speak to the people, they speak back. But the second best way is Babbel. And it's practical. It will very quickly teach you how to order food, ask for directions, speak to shopkeepers without having to consult language apps while you're on vacation. And here is a special limited time deal for our listeners right now. Get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for Fungal Associates at babbel.com/trees. That's right. If you're listening to this, if you're a fan of this show, babbel.com/trees. Get 60% off your subscription. That's babbel.com/trees. Rules and restrictions may apply. Adios. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Hi, everybody. It's Alex here. And you know what? Come springtime, those trees are a-bloomin'. Those people are a-walkin' around. That sun is a-shinin'. And it makes me so grateful for my social life. People are wanting to do things again, and it can be extremely rewarding to start to see friends more often and, you know, go on cute friend dates or romantical dates, sit on a patio and drink a coffee. Ooh la la. But it's really easy to overdo it. And for me, it's very important to keep an eye on my social battery. Every time I go on a social outing, I come home and I'm like, wow, I am really tired in a very specific way. Well, that's my battery. That's my social battery being drained. And I didn't really have this language until I started going to therapy. I didn't know why being around people made me so exhausted, even though I love those people and enjoy being around them. But therapy helped me with my self-awareness and helped me unlock some language that I didn't otherwise have. And if you are struggling with feelings and thoughts that you don't understand, therapy can be a great way to unlock the power of understanding. And a great way to start is BetterHelp. It's completely online and it's designed to be super convenient and flexible, which is very important. How many times have you had a therapy session on the calendar and that time rolls around and you think, I gotta drive all the way across town. I am not gonna go. It has, of course, happened to me. I'm sure it's happened to everybody who's been in therapy. No worries with BetterHelp. It's all online. And all you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire. You get matched with a licensed therapist, of course. And nobody nails it on their first time. It's like going on dates. You gotta find the right therapist for you. It's silly to think that the very first date you ever go on is going to be your future spouse. So you can switch therapists at any time, no additional charge. It's extremely easy. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/trees today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trees. Happy spring.
Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary. Today we're talking the honey locust, scientific name, Claditzii?
No. Claditz. Well, you're close.
Claditz.
Mm-mm. You're off on that that first sound you're making.
K.
Yeah, normally that letter's shaped like this. I want you to add a little this into it.
Claditzii.
Yeah, there we go. Man, was that good or was that good?
See, this is why we need a video podcast.
Yeah, because I just turned my C into a G. Nice. Yes, you're right. Claditzii.
Claditzii.
Triacanthos.
Triacanthos, yeah. While you're here.
Hey, yeah, thank you. I would love to try acanthos. Thank you very much.
It's good.
Yes, triacanthos. That is, so Claditzii, I think I told you, is named after this guy, Johann Gottlieb Gleditz.
Right.
Gleditsch. It's Gleditsch. And I believe Gleditsch. He is from Germany.
Wow, I could have guessed that one, Casey.
Who would have thought? Yeah, he was a...
His name is Gustav Frankenstein. I believe he's from...
it looks like South India is where he's from.
Hey, anybody can be from anywhere.
That is true. he was an old botanist, I think, in Berlin, and he did a lot of pioneering investigations of plant sexuality as Ooh. Well as reproduction.
What a freak.
Yeah, he was into it. Yeah, it was his thing. It was like, really, he was exploring his sexuality.
Of course, yes.
Via plants.
I mean, this would make a great biopic, Casey.
It really would. It would be very beautiful, but
we have this botanist exploring plant sexuality while his own sexuality is being discovered.
Exactly, and look at that.
Oh,
look
just at that picture. Brimming with sexuality, this guy.
Everyone, quickly, go to Johann Gottlieb Gleditz /wikipedia.com and just take a look at his photo. They really outdid his second chin.
Wow.
It's so good.
Well, Casey, let's imagine, as we do every episode, that you and I are walking. Hey, I know exactly where a honey locust is.
Oh,
it's about three or four blocks that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pointing toward the street here.
Yeah.
It's an interesting tree. It's a young one, but let's imagine that we're walking past it.
Yeah.
And I ask you, hey, ID that tree.
I'd say, Alex, I love this tree. Great question. Let's start with the first thing we see. It just dropped its leaves, actually. Just like in the last week, all of them have basically lost all of their leaves.
Oh, well.
Which is very curious because they're very closely related to the other famous curmudgeonly tree from the late Pleistocene era, which is the Kentucky coffee tree.
Ah, I was going to guess the black walnut.
Oh, yes. No, not quite. They are in very different families, not related in a significant close way.
Okay.
So all the leaves have dropped. They turn a nice bright yellow, mm-hmm. and they are pinnately compound leaves.
That's right. I love a pinnate compound.
Now, this one's even more fun because it actually puts out two different kinds of leaves. Hmm. Pinnately compound leaves, which, of course, those that have that central main vein that turns into a midrib or a rachis. And then, whoop, has little things coming off left and right, new little leaflets.
Yeah, that's right. We call them leaflets.
Yes.
And leaflets compounded, pinnately or palmately, create a compound leaf. That's
exactly right. You're compounding the leaf blades. So there is also bipinnately compound leaves. And this is really actually kind of fun because the bipinnately compound leaves are what generally come out of the more vigorous shoots. So this has kind of a dimorphic growth pattern along the twigs, which let me go back to that beautiful story we heard earlier. They're knuckly because they don't have a twig that has a terminal bud at the end. The terminal bud does not live. It just gets aborted. Hmm. So it only has twigs that come out of the side buds, and they're alternately arranged.
Mm.
So they have these little like knobs that grow a bunch of leaves from them, and those are pinnately compound leaves.
Okay.
But they kind of come out in all these different directions, so it kind of looks like this little spray of leaves that pop out.
Hmm.
But then at the end of the twig, where one of the buds is a shoot that goes outwards and it elongates, those leaves are bipinnately compound.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's very curious. So it has this double kind of texture to it.
The bipinnate part only happens sort of at the end of the twig?
Yes, pretty much.
Interesting. Correct. Okay.
So it's really kind of a beautiful little photo. So vigorous young shoots, those have the bipinnately compound leaves. The older buds down on older parts of the twig, those just have pinnately compound leaves.
Do they turn pinnate as they grow older?
No, they would grow. It's not a as they grow older kind of thing. It's like the first year shoot, that's the juvenile shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Then next year it becomes older and older and older, and then it starts to only put out the pinnately compound leaves.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's more the age of the twig, not how old it is over a season. Which really messed me up because I've heard this term a lot, like, oh, on the juvenile leaves. And I'm like, a leaf is one age. It does not age to be older or younger, you know?
Right.
So it does not have, oh, that's an adolescent leaf now. Oh, now that is an adult leaf.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the age of the twig that they're growing on.
I see.
How long that's been around. So those are the first things, of course, you would see if you were seeing it during the leaf-on season.
And I got to say, during the leaf-on season, it's quite a sight to behold.
Isn't it? It has this big crown, right? Have you seen any big ones around or just these smaller ones?
I guess not really big ones, no. Yeah. I mean, how tall did they grow?
About 80 feet. 80 feet is about the height that you'd normally find them.
That is far taller than any I've seen. I think the ones I've seen are probably 15 feet max.
Yeah, it makes sense. We're planting a lot more because they are tough. Trees.
Oh yeah,
we
good
used to
street
plant
trees.
Them. They're great street trees. Yeah, and we used to plant them all the time, and people would just—they kind of fell out of fashion, I guess. I don't really know, but they've just been consistently good trees to plant on the street. They're tough. They have a nice dappled shade because all those pinnately and bipinnately compound leaves—they let through like a really significant amount of light. In fact, I've recommended people plant this tree, and they're like, "Well, I need to plant a tree here, but I have these things that I don't want to get shaded out beneath," and I'm like, plant a honey locust.
Yeah, you know, I mean, in Photoshop terms,
uh-huh.
It's almost like you dragged your box over all the leaves and then like lowered the opacity to like 70%.
Yes, that's totally it.
They have this great sort of, I'm trying to think of another tree that does this, but like that dappled shade you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not just that the light is coming through between the leaves, mm-hmm. It's that they're coming through the leaves and it creates this sort of like glow effect
it
almost.
It does. That's totally right. Especially in the early fall when they start to go from light green to yellow.
Oh,
the glow effect just becomes intense.
Now, settle a bet. I have seen some of these honey locusts as they start to turn, as we say in zombie terminology.
Agreed.
That they sort of ombre. There's sort of a gradient effect.
Ooh.
Where it'll be like they kind of change color from the outward in, if that makes sense.
It may. Honestly, I haven't noticed explicitly on these leaves, but you might be right. You might be right.
I mean, that makes sense to me because it's like, you know, like on an airplane, right? The people, it's like the opposite of airplane. When you land in an airplane, everybody's getting off.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The people at the front of the plane have to get off first before the people at the back of the plane can get off first. So as the tree is sucking in its nutrients, its chlorophyll for next season,
it starts from the extremities out.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, in.
That would make sense to me.
Yeah. It also has a lot to do with the sun. Like what parts are in the sun, they often will change quicker.
Okay.
So those outer bits would probably change more than the ones that are just a little bit inner to the canopy.
Oh, they're a little more protected from the elements?
Not necessarily protecting it. It's just that they're getting hit by the sun. And as we'll talk about here in a second, trees and plants are very attuned to light. So if they are getting a certain amount of light, then they are triggered to do things more at a different time than one that doesn't get as much light.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. So they get the alert first.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah. Exactly.
Casey, I see from photos that this is in the, or I think you also maybe said this, this is in the pea family.
It is in the pea family. We talked about it just maybe a smidge, but yeah.
Can we go straight to the pea?
Oh, we can go straight to the pea. But then, before we do, I'll say that it grows up. And it gets big, big, big rounded canopy.
Mm.
And its bark is anything but utility. It's like spectacular bark.
Wow.
It's like plates that kind of grow off and kind of pop out.
Beautiful.
But the plates don't pop off. They just bend outwards. It's beautiful.
They're not popping off?
They are popping off, but they don't pop off. Yeah, right?
Damn, this tree's popping off.
It's so, I love the bark of an older, an older tree. Like,
yeah,
it's just so gorgeous.
I see some here. They're They almost look like satellite images of like canyons and
yeah. Oh my God, that's a great description.
Yeah,
and it's very. It looks very Thank similar you. Again to the Kentucky coffee tree, which is a sister group, sister clade to them.
Cool.
So they are very closely related, and of course you can see this. They're both in the pea family, as you noted. Difference being, the Kentucky coffee tree has strictly bipinnately compound leaves. They're huge. They're gigantic leaves.
Hmm.
Honey locusts do not. They have very small leaves. Comparably speaking.
Well, their leaflets are tiny, right?
Yes. Well, and
but
the
also
leaves,
their
the,
leaves.
Exactly. Okay. Both of them kind of put together. They are not outrageously large.
Yeah.
And their fruit is similar but different, where the fruit of a Kentucky coffee tree, it's about the size of the palm of your hand. It goes from about the tip to your the pad of your palm.
Okay.
And they're about... They're elongated. They look like big fat peas. Like they, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way. They look like big fat pea pods. They're
sure.
very succulent. They're like maybe a half inch thick, very leathery. Whereas the honey locust,
yeah.
they're like 3 or 4 times as long, like up to like 12 or 18 inches.
Really?
16. They're so big, like giant.
I see also maybe that they have sort of a spiral shape
yeah,
to them, the corkscrew.
Totally. They dry in a funny way. I don't wow. know why they do that, but they do. They dry and they kind of curve. And as they curve, they kind of become spring-like and like pull themselves inwards
oh
a little
gosh,
bit.
Oh my gosh, how fun.
Yeah. And they also are succulent inside, but not near as much as our Kentucky coffee tree.
Can you eat them?
No, not that I know of.
Okay.
I have not heard of anyone doing this. In fact, I was going to go find some Kentucky coffee tree and make some coffee. And then someone at a conference is like, oh, those are actually carcinogenic. And I was like, oh, maybe I won't. But I'll look it up first because I really, really want to go do that. Now's the time.
Yeah, okay.
So I might do that. If I find that it's okay, I'm going to do that. I can't remember if we found that that was okay or not, but I know this, every part of that tree is trying to kill you anyway. So
sure.
Yeah. We'll
that's an easy Google though.
It is an easy Google. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's essentially what our podcast is. It's just an easy Google.
We're like that. Have you seen that new AI generative, like, thing at the top of Google now, when
no.
you Google something, it'll like compile a little like list of resources it's found in like prose
no oh
to answer your question.
I have seen that, but I thought they've done that for a long time.
Well, sort of. This is a more advanced version.
Oh, because I guess they
would just show you like the top paragraph of the top link, essentially.
Yeah, it would find an excerpt from something.
Yeah, now they pull from lots of different sources and
wow.
give you a little thing.
So you're saying they're bingifying Google.
Yeah.
Wow.
They held out for as long as they could, but they finally had to buckle and bingify.
Yeah, I guess that's the case. Everyone does. Everyone
but
gets there.
We're sort of the AI generative little paragraph
yes.
of podcasts.
Oh, that's so good.
So yeah, they're curious peas, Casey.
They are. They're very curious peas, and they grew so big because they would be eaten by these old megafauna that have died away.
They are.
You got this.
Ecologically anachronistic.
Yes. Oh my God. Well done, Alex. That was fantastic.
Which means that at one point,
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you, Casey.
Yeah.
I love that phrase.
It's great.
It always takes me like 2 seconds to think of it, but it essentially means, everybody, come over here for a second. Casey already knows this. It means that at one time, this pea was enjoyed by a megafauna,
uh-huh.
such as a giant sloth or a grizzly beaver or whatever they had back then. And that megafauna died out, went extinct.
Mm-hmm.
However, this tree that adapted to be eaten by things that big has not gone extinct and has continued to grow these giant things that
exactly.
nothing eats.
That's it. That's perfectly it.
Another one that we talked about is the Osage orange.
Yes.
Which looks like this big, great fruit, and then you break into it and it's disgusting.
Yeah, nothing eats it.
And nothing can eat it
no.
or wants to eat it.
Why would you do? Why would you put your mouth around something so large?
We've heard horses sometimes enjoy the Osage
yes.
orange.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're
but,
the only things big enough, you know?
Right,
these
yeah.
days.
Got a big old mouth.
Yeah.
Which were enjoyed by these megafauna of the past.
That is so perfect. Very well done.
I also just love this idea as a concept.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, it's almost like looking at history,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
like ecological history. You're like,
yeah.
you are so old that the thing that eats you has been extinct for like 20,000 years.
Yeah. yeah.
That's very, very interesting.
It's crazy. It makes you think like, wow, man, things really do move slowly. Now, there's one other thing, though, we should note about these trees relating to megafauna.
Yes.
It's the second half of the scientific name, which is Triacanthos.
Three... something.
Thorns.
Ah, yes.
Arms
okay,
is what
yes.
it means. Yeah. So it's a...
Canthos' arms?
I think so. Okay. That's what I recall reading, but I actually can't recall specifically.
All right.
Yeah, I was. I think I believe I wrote it down, but yes, essentially, whatever the actual Latin derivatives are, it does mean that it essentially has thorns that split into threes.
I always love when Casey Down Under Clap comes to visit.
Well, he always brings his knife.
That's not a knife.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. That's not enough. But this is a tree that has the most vicious thorns on it.
Yeah.
They are technically, I think, spines because they come from dormant buds, I believe.
Oh, yeah. I forgot there was a difference.
Ever so slightly.
I pegged them for spines.
Yeah. And the reason you know is because they split. So that means that they would be branch tissue that grows out and then a bud comes out and then they turn into more.
So these are spines.
Yes. I believe that is the case. Yes, I could do, as we just noted, a quick Google search, but we do this live.
We're already here.
We're never going to look back.
We're already here.
Yeah. In fact, all I'm going to do is like reference an episode where we did talk about this one time and we're like, go listen to that episode if you want to learn more about that.
This is the arbitrary way.
Yeah. What episode was it? I don't know. Start at the first and then just go through until you hear it.
Go chronologically. I'm sure it was where we talked about the umbrella thorn.
Yes, I think you're probably right. Yeah.
But yeah, these spines are quite vicious looking.
They're insane. Yeah. And the idea would be that they would have kept an animal from climbing up or breaking or pulling on it, because they're not really on the small twigs. They're actually coming out of the main stems and the larger branches.
Yeah.
So leads you to believe that it was more trying to keep animals off of the main big part of it. So you wanted them, or they wanted you, just to eat the branches and the leaves and the things that are out on the extremities. Do not break my stem.
Now, okay, is that because like no animal today could break the stem of a tree, an 80-foot tree?
Yeah,
but we're talking about when animals were a little bit bigger.
Well, this is that if once a tree gets to 80 feet, yeah, you're good.
Maybe do the spines even grow when it's older?
They do, but they grow and they age and then they just kind of decay and fall away.
Okay,
but this would be you don't want an animal when the tree is small, when the tree is able to be broken something that is, you know, 1.5 times the size of an African elephant.
I see.
Like they could just walk over and be like, "Yep, you're on the ground now."
So the animal would walk up and be like, ooh, spines. Ah, I don't want to touch that. But ooh, look at that yummy seed pod there.
Exactly. And then they'd get on their hind legs or something. And they'd pull off the branches from the outer extremities.
I gotcha.
But they would not necessarily climb up into the tree and like break it in half.
I gotcha. Okay.
But again, we don't really know. But that's just what we can look at and say, probably.
Sure.
But we don't know what the interactions were other than the fruit. We can be very positive about the fruit. We've actually seen a lot of these in dung that we found in coprolites, which are essentially petrified dung from animals. We've seen fruit in this way. Alex is like, yeah, oh, wow. Who's doing that research? Sign me up.
Bunch of shit kickers.
And they're like, yeah, thank you. Thank you. Really appreciate that.
It's on my business card.
we're not for sure, but you know, you can only make inferences. You can say, well, there's giant animals and there's giant spines on this tree. Huh. I wonder if they're connected.
There are a lot of intelligent people putting these pieces together.
There are. Yeah.
You just have to have logic and some context and you're good to go. Usually and
you figure it out.
Yeah.
But Alex, that is in fact something that we've talked about so many times before.
Megafauna.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Our subject today actually has far more to do with the first line of the epic story called The Sixth Sense, which is, there is a tree that lurks in the dark, a tree that sees the darkness.
Now, this is interesting. Now, what did Clap mean by this?
I really don't know, but it seems that what his language was very intentional.
It sees in the dark. And what was the second part?
No. Lurks in the dark.
It lurks.
And it sees the darkness.
It sees the darkness.
Yes. It's not that it sees in the dark.
How is sees spelled?
As in vision.
Okay.
S-E-E.
See, I read it as sees, as in the day.
Ah, a tree that sees, seizes the, I see. Okay. Yeah. No, it sees the darkness.
What does that mean, Casey?
Well, what that means is that there are, let me back up just real fast. I years ago. By years ago, I mean, I think last year. Read a book called What a Plant Knows.
There it is.
By Daniel, I think I'm going to say Chemovitz.
Okay.
And he is a Israeli author and scientist and has done a lot of research on how plants actually perceive the world. Not in a way that is like there's actually just another article came out recently that I read that is basically saying we need to pump the brakes on anthropomorphizing plants.
Right.
And I read you know the abstract and I was like I'm going to get back to this because it's essentially scientists saying stop anthropomorphizing plants. They don't see, they don't love, they don't like, we can't add these human traits to plants. I have my issues with that, which we've talked about a little bit, and maybe we'll talk about again, and I'll just go on a rant here, and you can get on the Patreon, and you can hear what I have to say about that. But that is, we use the term humanizing trees, where we're not saying that a tree is actually loving and actually seeing. Like you said, stress. Like you have a problem saying, oh, a tree's stress. Like, it's a human term.
Right.
That we're giving to a tree, but the trees are doing something different. They're not having the same exact response from the same stimuli, et cetera, et cetera. So this book is basically a scientific look to saying, well, okay, if we are going to accept the premise that a tree has the five senses, quote unquote, let's explore that. Let's see what actually happens. And without anthropomorphizing, because he's a scientist, he basically goes through the literature and scientifically says, here is how a tree is looking and seeing and interacting. And he goes through this definition and says, well, here we are. We're humans, Alex, you and I. I'm pretty sure.
Nothing.
So humans, we have eyes, and our eyes have these little cones and rods in them, right?
Hey, we're a lot more like trees than we thought.
We really are.
We
except
have cones.
We do. Oh, Alex,
that was
you, son of a gun.
Pretty surface level.
Yeah, no, it was good. I love that. So this is like in the back, like on our retina.
Right.
And I think I read that humans have, and this is, I think is in his book, the very first chapter, which is the one that catches you, right? We have something like 38 megapixels worth of like vision. Whereas like most things, like the highest end camera has like eight or something. That's because what we have is we have these two things. We have these cones and rods. Now, cones see certain colors, and then rods see all color but in a gradient. They basically see light and dark. Or rather, they see light, and therefore they know if it's dark. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So,
it's
a binary. All you need to do is see one, and if you don't see it, you know it's the other.
Right.
So in this case, with cones, we have only three colors, red, green, and blue. So we have certain cones that see each of that. So if someone is colorblind, they essentially do not have one of those cones.
Interesting.
Yeah, they have all the others, but they don't have that one.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that is like if you're colorblind, red or blue, I think.
Oh.
Is it red? I don't know. I think there's like certain ones.
Green colorblind, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. You look at those books that have like numbers and circles in
it. That's right. Yeah.
So that is, that's how our vision works. And essentially light comes in and it hits those rods. And if it's blue light, then it hits the blue receptor. And if it is red, it hits the red one. Now, if you have a light that's halfway in between, some of it hits one and some of it hits the other. And then our brains put it together and we interpret it and all that.
To bring it back to Photoshop, RGB, that's
exactly
the color mode. And if you can put, you know, 30% R, 40% G, right? And that makes a certain color.
Exactly.
I don't know off the top of my head.
Who knows? Yeah. We're not going to go into all the different color things because it's also weird in terms of like light coming in is white light and then it gets refracted out with like a prism.
Yeah
it freaks you out when you're like mixing paint versus something else. Anyway, we're not going to wade into it.
Mm-hmm.
Suffice it to say, that's how humans see something, but
right.
We see in pictures. That's a big takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
We interpret all the things in front of us
right.
as a picture.
It's not reality. It's just like how our eyes are perceiving it.
Exactly. Which, you know, we round up to say, yeah, this is reality. This is how I see it. But reality is different from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, we're not going to wade into that perspective side of this.
Maybe someday.
Maybe someday we'll get there. Because today we're going to be talking more about the tree's perception of reality. And a tree has these same different photoreceptors in them. And this is something that when I was reading this book, I was like, okay, cool. What exactly is sight in plants? If we are going to round up and say, let's just say trees have sight. And the biggest difference between trees and humans, or any other animal really for that matter, but then, Jesus, let's not even talk about ants or like mantis shrimp, you know? Like those are the compound eyes in insects that see things in like every direction all at once and all these different things.
Wild.
Versus a mantis shrimp that can like see through walls and fucking, like, they perceive the world in a way we can't even conceive
That's
of.
That's fucking scary.
We're not even going to get into that. Look at these three things that we're not getting into. Look at, I'm very proud of us, Alex, for not going down these rabbit holes. So your plants, they are seen in a different way. They're not seen with pictures. They just have receptors to say, uh-huh, registered.
Now, can I guess what these receptors are?
Yes.
Is it leaves? Well, it's not quite leaves. It's what's inside the leaf.
Isn't it always? I'm going to tell that to my children.
Chlorophyll?
No, Alex. It's not your leaves. It's what's inside your leaves.
That sees.
Nico make us proud.
Is it the chloroplast or the chlorophyll that they're like little? I mean, they are literally little light receptors, right?
Yeah. But they're not so much light receptors as light absorbers.
Okay.
So your chlorophyll is absorbing all these different photons at these different wavelengths, and then using that to create energy to rip apart and recombine water and CO2.
So I'm a little off in terms of what I think, how I think trees see.
You are only off in that there is a different set of proteins that we just collectively call photoreceptors.
Okay.
Those, I believe trees have many, and I tried to find something that spoke specifically to our tree, the honey locust, but it doesn't. There's lots of different people who've done lots of different research, but it usually comes down to like reed canary grass or Thaliopsis. It's like this.
Oh,
little,
these are like the commonly researched plants in terms of photoreception.
Yeah, and they're just commonly researched all the time. They're essentially the plant that everyone has. They're very easy to grow, and you can manipulate them in certain ways. So everyone's like, "Great, let's just use those."
Okay,
like they're just extremely well known.
I got you.
So these in trees, there are a few different ones. The first that we're going to talk about, which we talked about a while back when we talked about the drunken forests of the melting areas up in the north.
Yeah.
So those were black spruces, and we talked about phototropism.
Yeah.
And phototropism exists in all trees, and they grow out as wherever the light is. That's what they're growing towards.
Right. This is one of my favorite takeaways from our podcast of all
time. Yeah. Okay. That makes my day. So phototropism, it turns out, is only actually like caused by blue light.
Interesting.
If you don't have any other light, you just shine pure blue, a tree will move towards that blue light. If you do not shine blue light, you shine it only red light, the tree will grow straight up as if it's blind.
That is fascinating.
Or it will grow wherever there's blue light, I suppose. But if it's completely dark, let's say.
So if our sun was a what is it called, a red giant or whatever?
Oh yeah.
Then trees wouldn't do phototropism.
They wouldn't do phototropism. Yeah, very likely. That's a very good point. Yeah.
Interesting.
Now I don't know. Yeah, you know, there's going to be some astronomer out there who's like,
we're not even close to being even informed on that stuff.
That is our fourth rabbit hole we're not going to go down. Yeah, listen to this tree podcast. They just talked about astronomy and what is a red giant versus a blue dwarf.
Once in a while.
Yeah, we'll get there. We still have 72,000 800 trees to do.
If you think it seems like we are running out of content now.
Oh, just wait.
We'll see you in a couple of years.
Oh man. So this is that's what the blue light does.
That's very interesting.
Right?
Why?
It's just a means of separating things. Because if the sun, I mean, look up at the clouds, I guess, or look up at the sky.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually blue. We see the blue sky, right?
Right.
So it is, as the sun, this is our one foray into this. The sun sends out white light, and white light is all of the lights put together.
Yes, it contains all colors.
Contains all colors. So that light is shining down, and a tree is essentially saying, okay, cool, I'm going to take all that light in these receptors, which are the chloroplasts, and then I'm going to reflect back green, because the green is just the one I'm not going to use. That's why plants are green. They absorb all the other wavelengths of light. If the plant is on these other photoreceptors, taking in that same white light, it is actually only taking cues from the blue light, just because that photoreceptor, which is essentially a protein, that protein is designed and flipped in such a certain way that it will only react or change or make any kind of stimulus reaction to blue light.
Interesting.
So why is that? I don't really know, other than the fact that, yeah, when you look up and out, it's this bright light that wants to come, and blue light coming down from the sky with all the other lights. Maybe it's just that it's like, ah, well, it's on this side of the spectrum, and I know that that is where the rest of the light is going to be.
Mm.
Now, maybe this is going to be a little bit informed when I tell you this next thing, which is red light and far red light, which is essentially like the darkest red you can ever imagine.
Is that like infrared?
It's just before that.
Okay.
So far red, we can technically see. Uh-huh. I Googled this, and it just looks essentially black. Like, it's really, really, really low wavelength. Okay. Red light.
Okay.
And just after that is going to be infrared, which we cannot see with our naked eye.
Right.
So,
however, the mantis shrimp. You know they can see infrared.
Can't see it. Oh my God. So it turns out, Alex, that there is red light receptors as well.
Okay.
Now, what is exciting about that?
In trees?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah. And so these red light receptors, they are called phytochrome, which means plant color.
Okay.
Easy as that. So what is fascinating about this is Darwin initially, he and his son Francis did this first initial phototropism experiment, which is the cutest like experiment you can ever do.
That's good. Those are core memories.
Oh, they really are. Yeah. Francis really took that and did everything, just really went off. But
Francis Darwin.
Look at this.
Casey is showing me
it's a little diagram.
Uh-huh.
And here's a little candle over here, and you can look this up on Google, and everyone has redone this.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They made a dark room. They put a bunch of seeds of reed canary grass, Phalaris canariensis, and they had these little seedlings growing up.
Yeah.
And they left one completely normal. Then they took another one and they clipped the tip of it off. So they just clipped off the top.
Okay.
The next one, they put a opaque cap on it.
Right.
It's like a little grass seedling growing up, and they just went weep and put like a little tiny thimble on top of it.
Little blackout goggles.
Exactly. The second one, they put out a see-through little cap.
Oh.
So the cap was like glass, I think. And then they just put this glass cap on. Wow. So it is going to be blocking certain things, but not light. And then the last one, they took like a tube and blocked the middle section of the plant.
I see.
So they're trying to figure out, okay, do plants see A, and what part of the plant sees B?
Yes, they're blocking the light from certain parts of the blade of grass.
Yes. And so they found that it's the tip that moves, or the tip that sees, but then it actually bends a little bit further down.
Okay.
So that has all to do with auxin and all the other phototropic things that we talked about, where essentially as this plant is growing down, or as it gets light from these photoreceptors, those photoreceptors say, okay, you produce auxin, you don't produce auxin. And then that makes it either elongate the growth or not elongate the growth. So if you have the left side elongating, or in your perspective, the left side elongating, then the right side doesn't elongate, you get a bend in the resulting tip of the tree.
I see. So it's not really growing toward the light.
Yeah.
It's like growing, it's like being pushed toward the light.
Exactly.
By itself.
Because one side is growing faster.
I know that sounds a little silly, but that's sort of how I thought of it. Like, that's really interesting. I'm not even sure what I'm trying to say here, Case.
Well, it's this easy, like very clever mechanism.
Yeah,
right?
That's great.
So
very
that
smart.
Is, yeah, that's the blue light. And that's this initial thing that they found, the Darwins found. Then years later, people kept looking at it and realized, okay, first off, it's only blue light that they actually move to. But when you shine red light at a plant, it does something different.
Mm.
And this is the fun part that I was like, whoa.
Tell me more.
So red light will make a plant flower.
Wow.
And if it gets far red light, it will not, as if it is a switch.
Now, this to me says that the sun, you know, that sun just hits different in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And there's maybe more red light coming from the sun in the springtime.
Nope.
Okay.
You're close though. You're not far off.
Okay.
You just have, you basically have all the puzzle pieces there, but you put them in the wrong order.
You're so good at telling me I'm wrong.
You're welcome, Alex. This is what I'm here for.
Tell me how it's right.
All
right,
dumbass. So here's how, this is, it's, you're right in the sense that in spring, the days are getting longer.
Right.
So it's not that there is a bigger or a shorter amount of red light, because it just so happens red light happens when the sun first comes up in the morning.
Ah.
Just pops over that horizon.
Okay.
The leaves, every single leaf on a plant, and it only takes one, literally just one leaf. All of them are waiting and seeing. They all are covered with these photoreceptors that collect only red light. So going back to your question earlier, why is it blue? It could be that they already had red photoreceptors doing certain things. So they're like, okay, well, we need a different receptor to take a different kind of light to do a different mechanism in our growth.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, okay, blue light, you are going to be connected to auxin, and you are going to make this grow in a certain direction to get us the most sunlight. Now, red, you are going to be here, and you're going to give us an idea of how long the day is, or more specifically, how long the night is.
Right.
This is the trees seeing the darkness.
It's how long the sun is in the sky.
Yeah.
And anytime it's not means it's nighttime.
Precisely. But it actually works again in the opposite direction, where the tree is measuring when it gets that far red light, mm-hmm. which I should add, Alex, is the last bit of light that you see at dusk. Mm-hmm. It just kind of flashes out there for a little bit, and it's just like, oh, far red light.
Wow.
The tree has these receptors that are these proteins, these phytochromes, and essentially when red light hits them, then they become receptive to far red light.
Oh my God.
When far red light hits them, they switch and they become receptive to red light.
What the hell?
So it basically says, as the sun comes down and then blasts them with this far red light, that's when the timer starts.
Wow. When you say timer... Oh, forgive me.
Sorry. No, you can ask your question. I was just having a good time.
I thought the timer was going to go off.
Oh yeah,
when it does. When the sun sets.
It will have to wait the entire night though, so it'd make this a very long podcast.
Woo, marathon record. Yeah,
8 hours later.
Okay. So when you say, because you use the terminology or the diction, that the tree takes in these spectrums of light.
Yeah.
The spectrum of light.
Uh-huh.
Bounces back green, because that's the only one, quote, it doesn't use.
Yeah.
It's using these other colors of light.
Yeah, but it's also different mechanisms. So different things would be taken in different light. But it does happen that this is red, blue, and then green's reflected away.
Because those are the three major colors of light.
No, I'm not sure why.
I'm a little lost on light. I need like light 101.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. So you have Roy G. Biv, right? Which is your red, orange, yellow,
sure,
blue.
Yeah.
Roy G. No, green. B-I-V, which
blue,
is
indigo, violet.
Exactly. And so then you have on the other side of that is the big blue one, the big purple one, black light essentially.
Uh-huh.
And then on the other side is infrared.
Okay.
And we can't see those past the Roy G. Bivs. So when light hits something, it is absorbed, and whatever color our eyes are seeing,
uh-huh.
that is what's reflected back.
Okay, yeah.
So that's why trees are green. They're absorbing all of the other light, and they're reflecting back green, which means they are not using the green light. The green light hits and bounces and goes away.
Okay.
Everything else gets absorbed into the leaf.
And they use those different colors.
Well, here's the...
I know so little. Yeah. I understand so little that I sound like a fucking kindergartner.
This is perfectly fine. Fine, Alex.
I hate this.
If you explained to me the way that music works, it would be the same thing, just switched.
Fair enough.
So do not... I was literally looking at this book. Yeah.
I just got this new book, The Guitar Grimoire. which I love.
Just like, it sounds terrifying. It sounds like a demon that comes out of your guitar and you play it wrong.
Right.
Ah, the Grimnar. Oh, Grimnar. God.
And it is like reading Black Magic. It is so in depth and crazy, but I think I understand it. But I see what you're saying, Casey.
So in this case, Alex, imagine there's three different jars.
Mm-hmm.
One jar collects blue light, and all of the light coming out of the sun is filled with all of them. It is all light coming down together. So it is 100% of all the spectrum from the sun. But this jar only is designed to collect and separate out the Roys and the G's and the Bivs.
Okay.
So this jar only collects red. Actually, this jar only collects red and far red. That's all it's designed to do. So it has a certain shaped top so that only the certain wavelength size can fit into it. Everything else is either too big or too small.
Okay.
Then you have another jar. The second jar only collects the blue light.
Mm-hmm.
It has just the right protein that the only the correct size wavelength for blue can make it into that jar. Everything else hits it and bounces away.
Got it.
Meanwhile, as it bounces away, it might hit all, go into the chlorophyll, and then the chlorophyll will say, sweet, now I got this. But this happens all on like these teeny tiny little levels.
Yeah.
The chlorophyll has a jar that collects everything except the green wavelength.
Yeah.
So everything goes in there and that one wavelength just can't fit, so it bops back out.
And that's what we see.
Yes, that's what we see.
All right.
So all these other photoreceptors are very similar to our eyes, where we have it back there. We can see these colors, but we also don't none of it is, some of it's reflected, but our eyes are so black because they are literally, our pupils are absorbing every ounce. Mm. So if you see something that is black, it's absorbing 100% of that light that's coming in.
Whoa.
Nothing is reflecting back. That's why it's black.
Whoa.
So I said we weren't going to get into this, Alex, and now we're here, and Alex is just,
where do we go
going
from
into space. Here is where we're going to go.
Okay.
A tree, you noted measure, and I thought you were going to go measure down this way when you said it earlier, and I was happy you didn't, but now we're going to circle back.
Okay.
Because this is the thing that makes, like, should give you pause. Trees are able to, quote, see the light. Right. In the same way that we can, quote, see the light.
Uh-huh.
We just have this brain that interprets it, and then our brain sees it as a literal picture in front of us.
Uh-huh.
We can say, okay, cool, there is everything, I can move, I can interact with it, I understand this as a picture. A tree does not have that ability to see in a picture. Everything works on its own, so that one protein is receptive to red, and then as soon as it gets hit by red, it switches and becomes receptive to far red. So imagine a light switch that turns on and off.
Mm-hmm.
It turns on when the dawn happens.
On dawn.
It turns off when dusk
off
happens.
Dusk.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, it turns out that trees and plants, generally speaking, do not measure, they don't keep track of the length of the day. They keep track of the length of the night.
I see.
So that's why I said in my story, they see the darkness. Because as soon as that far red hits them at dusk, they keep track. And then as they keep track, when the dawn happens and they turn on again, then they say, aha, cool, the daytime is this long. Because they, just like that binary I'm talking about,
they're not measuring the length of the day, they're measuring the length of the night, which exactly gives them the length of the day.
Precisely. And the reason that we know this is that we have done a lot of experimentation on this, and people in the cut flower industry really want to make sure that the plant that they really want to sell is able to grow and produce flowers during that time of the year. So in this book, they use chrysanthemums and iris and all these kinds of really beautiful flowers that we would love to have. So how do we make those plants flower out of season? Because most plants are either going to be short day or long day growers and producers of flowers. And what this means is that they measure the length of night to know how long the day is going to be. And we are not clear on how they can remember that.
Like, yeah.
That's the part that I'm like, that should give everyone pause.
Yeah.
And this is why I'm like, shut up, scientists. Let's just say that trees see, because they also have memory.
I chalk, and I'm as you know, I'm one of the world's most renowned scientists.
You are.
That's a very funny way to usually it's more specific. I my theory is that they've just, it's like an evolutionary knowing, evolutionary memory, right?
Yeah.
That they just know because they've been doing it for so long.
Sure, but it still is a kind of memory, and it still has to be an acute memory. Maybe they develop the ability to have that memory, but they're still keeping track of it every year.
That is interesting.
So iris, for instance, are longer days. So during the growing season, during spring, like you said, there's going to be you know, more sunlight. There is, but they're only keeping track of the very beginning and the very end, or the very end and the very beginning, depending on how you're looking at it.
Wow.
And that plant is keeping track. Okay, how long was that day? Okay, cool. How long was that day? Okay, cool. It's getting longer. As it gets to a certain point, then the flower says, boom, turn on those hormones, add the petals, create this, and now they have this flower.
mobilize.
It's time, everyone. Take your pants off.
Let's get
That's what Iris says every midsummer.
I'm gonna bleep that because it was so vulgar.
So bad. You gotta like spit it out.
That's a hard F. And well, that is the stick sense.
That is the stick sense.
Wow.
And it's literally the stick at the tip of the twigs.
Yeah.
That's the blue light receptors that move things around.
Works on multiple levels.
The leaves, they're the ones that are doing the blue and the red light, excuse me.
Sure.
Yeah. And so it's like, whoa, hold on. A plant can see and remember how long, what the last color was that it saw. Was that red or was that far red? And then it remembers how long in between those two things happen. And it knows if it starts to get shorter at the end of summer, then all the fall plants start to bloom. It's because they are short days. So they're keeping track of the days getting long and then getting short again.
It's almost like, it's more like a computer than a human brain.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. The stick sense is more just a computer thing. Yeah, if you really like just...
Only because it's like, it's binary and it's like a,
yes,
it's
yeah.
like a, it's like timed, right?
Yeah. It's just, it's a fun mechanism.
It's very fun.
Yeah. There you go.
What a blast.
So this is what our tree's doing. We brought up that this tree, our tree has lost its leaves.
Yes.
We also talked years ago about the, Kentucky coffee tree. The Kentucky coffee tree is a tree that is the last to put its leaves out and the first to start dropping them. They probably have dropped most of their leaves the same as the honey locust. They are keeping intense track of the weather. And this is probably also something that comes from the Pleistocene, where the ancient glaciers used to come down and everything was very cool and these plants would only have the right amount of time and energy and space. Only this very teeny tiny short period of time. So they're like, oh, no, I'm not going to put my leaves out yet because I know in late June, there's always a frost. It's been like this for 50,000 years.
Okay.
That does not happen anymore, but it's not keeping track of the temperature. It may be keeping track of temperature. This is a whole other thing to add in, but it's mostly the days. It's measuring the
That in itself is sort of an ecological anachronism.
It is, 100%. Yeah. And that is like the next level ecological anachronism.
Yeah.
It's not the fruit. This is now the physiology of the plant's the plant's circadian rhythm.
It's the day-to-day operations.
Yeah. Wild, Alex.
Very interesting, Casey.
There you go.
Well, that was our fascinating. I need to speak to my pastor.
Yeah.
My mind is blown, man.
It is, yeah. So our honey locust, it just keeps getting just more intense.
And we're gonna give a rating to this honey locust, but it's gotta happen after a break. We will be right back, and we'll see you very soon here on Completely Arbitrary. Alex here. Here's a little something about me. I love to be cozy. Coziness is of utmost importance to me, and I am in a constant search for coziness. And that is why we present to you Cozy Earth. Cozy Earth makes luxurious bedding and clothing products. And what do I mean by luxurious? Let me tell you this. I now have Cozy Earth sheets on my bed. I wear a full Cozy Earth sweatsuit to bed, and I have been getting the best sleep of my life. It is quite literally the softest material I've ever put on my body, and my skin is so happy in it. I usually have a little bit of a sensory thing. I don't like things touching my skin. Clothes are tough, but with Cozy Earth, I am treated to superior softness, unparalleled fabric, materials, and weave. This is a real endorsement. It's the most comfortable material to ever grace my birthday suit. And guess what? You deserve this coziness too. So treat yourself to the ultimate in comfort and indulgence with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear. And you know what? Completely Arbitrary listeners, a little inside detail here. You all get 35% off at CozyEarth.com with promo code TREES. That's T-R-E-E-S for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. Now you go and get cozy.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary. That was our discussion of the Honey Locust.
And Casey. The stick sense.
And the stick sense. Oh, that sense is stick.
What?
It's time for a review of the Honey Locust. And here's how it works. We're going to give some final thoughts on this tree and then give it a rating of 0 to 10. Golden jack-o'-lanterns of honor.
What? Alex.
The lowest hanging fruit you could possibly imagine,
it's
but there it is.
Literally on the ground.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
Casey is our resident expert. We will begin with you.
All right. So.
Sorry. Begin with boo.
Oh, geez. All right. Just let's move on. I happen to have a very lovely experience with these trees.
Mm.
Two ways. One, they are a tree that I just think are spectacular to be planted everywhere.
Cool.
They grow very well. They have a unique like flavor to them. Hmm. I think they look very tropical or like kind of semi-tropical.
Yeah.
You know, like a savanna kind of tree.
For sure, yeah.
And I like that they produce shade, but it's a dappled shade. And I think that's more palatable to a lot of people where they don't want something that is like dark and dreary. Although I do like that also. Well, so, you know, it goes all ways. But they are like very, very beautiful trees. They have a nice texture to them. I like their knuckly growth, the way they have this. And if anyone ever sees them, just pay attention to this knuckly growth.
Okay.
It really is a unique thing for them.
Quit saying knuckly growth.
I can't, Alex. It's the best way to describe it. There's literally no other way to describe the growth other than knuckly. Luckily, I'll move on.
Thank you.
The bark, I think, is great, and I love that this tree's covered in thorns.
Yeah.
Though, we don't usually plant the thorned version. There's a variety that's naturally occurring called Anermis, and it doesn't have fruit or thorns. So it's essentially, who cares?
Yeah, where's the party? Come on.
Where's the party? I know.
Yeah.
Like, there's no danger. There's no sex. It's like, this is a tree that has just been turned into an inert growing thing.
It's what the people want.
It's what the people want. Just what a... fine. I get it. But man, I love a tree that has this weird thing that you're just walking around, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a grotesque amount of thorns. Like, you could cut off some branches and you could use them to absolutely destroy something.
Sure. Like it's like a baseball bat covered in nails.
Yes, yeah. It's exactly what it's like. Like, it's insane.
Speaking of zombies.
Yeah, if there's a zombie apocalypse, this is the tree you want to go find. Cut off one of the branches and then just, you know, wait for it to grow all of its response growth and thorns and then use it to kill them.
Have yourself a good old time.
So I think that tree, I just think it has so much to offer in terms of arboriculture, in terms of its aesthetic value, in terms of its curiosity in a biological and arboricorial, That's a fun word. In a sense of being a tree and biological organism.
Yeah.
It's just a cool tree.
Yeah.
I really think it's great. It doesn't do anything that's like outstanding, you know, like there's not some wild, amazing thing. We're not even sure if it actually produces its own nodes to do, what is it? Nitrogen fixing the way a lot of legumes do. It's really up in the air. People are like, man, does it? I'm not sure if it does. It might be ancient. It might be not ancient. No one's quite sure. So, as a overall tree, I got to give it like a 7.9.
Very respectable.
It's respectable. It's the Michelin star kind of 7.9.
Oh, yeah.
In order to get up to 8, you have to like really blow my socks
off. That's one star for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a special tree. It's a gorgeous tree. It should be planted more. I don't think it's planted enough, though I think it could be. So don't go too crazy. You know, just plant it at a walking pace.
Sure.
But don't stop walking.
We're not in a dire need for these trees.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, here and there, why not?
Here and there. Yeah, they're great. They also have very few pests. Like they're a good tree.
Solid tree.
Solid tree with a lovely history.
And a solid score, 7.9 golden jack-o'-lanterns.
That's right. That's right. Now, that is my opinion, Alex. What do you think about this tree?
Well, I am quite fond of the honey locust.
You are.
I love a bipinnately compound leaf. I love a pinnately compound leaf, and this one has both.
Yeah, it does. It's got it all. It's a whole package, so to speak.
I also love the shape of the leaflet. It's like a little, it's like a little pill shape almost.
Yeah.
I think they're beautiful trees. I love a tree that grows a defense like that, and it's such like a funny, I mean, speaking of low-hanging fruit, it's like a defense that's, it's not chemical. It's not, you know, we can see it. It's spikes.
Yes.
Like, it's right there.
It's not being shy or coy about its defensive.
Or smart about it. It's just like, yeah, I'm going to cover myself in spikes.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that'll work. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, you developed eyes? Me too. So I can see that you can see that I'm going to kill you.
That I'm covered in spikes. And I love the overall shape and size of it. I love ecological anachronisms, and this one's got it. Man, the only thing that's missing for me, is an edible fruit. One,
It's not. You're kind of edible.
No,
yeah.
Like if this thing was covered in like, mangoes is. A mango type.
One.
This seems like a tree that would grow a big droop.
It does. It really. It has that like. It's the tropical feel to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that would put it over. Or if it if I had some sort of like emotional attachment to it, I think would help it.
Yeah.
I don't really have a grand history with it doesn't mean a lot to me.
Some people
heart.
Do, but it's only those that have seen it crawling across the prairies and the forests.
Yeah.
They'd be like, don't come near me.
Yes. What does that mean?
That was from the story that was passed down through generations.
I see. Sorry. I missed that verse.
I can do it again.
I loved it. One viewing was enough, like the Northman. I give this a
7.35.
Yeah.
Why have you split it up?
It just feels right, Case.
You
I'm
just
going with
keep
my heart.
Going, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
7.35 golden jack-o'-lanterns of honor.
All right. Yeah. It's got that extra, what is it? That's a hundredth. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why.
Sometimes you just got to do it. It's what's ever in your heart.
Yeah. That just feels right to me. Yeah, I think it's a fine tree. I'd like some more familiarity with it. I'd like to go see some big ones.
Okay.
I've only ever seen 15-foot, brand new, just planted by the city in a planter strip, you know?
Uh-huh.
So if I got some more experience, I'm sure that would bump up. But where I'm at right now.
Blandina, just a few blocks east of Borthwick Avenue.
This is Casey's superpower.
And 15th Avenue. Right about 9th or 10th.
Very good.
It's on the south side of the street.
Now, you know
Not Avenue. Not Street 15th. Not Street. Around 9th or maybe 10th Avenue.
Now, you know about me that verbal directions or any of that just goes in one ear and out the other. I cannot. So we'll have to go there and let me see them.
Yeah, okay. This is, go to Blandina Street and just drive up and down it between Williams and Albina.
Still too much.
God dang it. Okay. I'll drop you a pin.
That was our review of The Honey Locust. Casey, it's time for our completely arbitrary Q&A.
I love a good Q&A, Alex.
Boy, don't we all. This one is from Nathan.
Right.
Nathan says, hey there, tree people. Hi, Nathan. I recently took a trip to the Pacific Northwest. All right.
What a beautiful place.
Squamish and Northwest Washington, to be exact.
Yes, okay. Very, very covered in dark, big trees.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because one of the many things that stood out to me, says Nathan, was the amount of moss on the big leaf maple, Acer macrophyllum.
That's right.
Compared to its coniferous friends.
Yes.
What allows or helps the moss to grow more on the maples than the neighboring conifers? Mm. Thanks, Nathan.
Love
now,
this.
We've talked about before that specifically big leaf maples are sort of epiphyte heads.
They are. They love them.
They love, an epiphyte is like a moss or a lichen.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Anything that grows on another plant.
Okay.
So on the surface, not as a parasite,
yes,
but grows on top of, without, and this is a specific thing, any connection down to the ground. So a vine is not an epiphyte.
Mm.
A mistletoe parasite is not an epiphyte. It is a parasite, specifically.
How about a western hemlock growing on the limb of a giant sequoia?
Or
a western red cedar.
Yeah. I think you could call that an epiphyte. I think you would have to move that up to an epiphyte thing. The tree doesn't, it's not its natural way. It's not doing that because it's designed to be an epiphyte. It happens to just grow where the conditions were right.
I understand. You know? Okay, so yeah, Casey, big leaf maples are just prolific with epiphytes.
They are.
Why?
Great question, Alex.
And why does the giant conifer next to it not share those same qualities?
Now that is the real question, isn't it?
This is
the classic scientific conundrum where you can say, this must be because of this. But if everything else in the situation is exactly the same,
right,
it's not happening somewhere else, you're missing something,
the
right?
The conditions for a big leaf maple and a Douglas fir 10 feet away from it are essentially the same.
Essentially the same.
So why do the epiphytes love the big leaf maple?
Such a great question. We had an entire episode where we talked about this.
Oh,
you remember?
Wow. No.
Well, we talked about this in an episode about the big leaf maple. I think it was, honestly, I think it was just about a year ago, maybe a little bit more.
I think it was the big leaf maple episode.
Yeah, it was that one. Yeah, I don't remember the name of it, honestly. Yeah. But it's a...
BLM.
It was. I think that's what it was. Yeah, it was BLM.
Yeah.
Because I always call them BLMs.
That's right.
So the BLM... for whatever reason, as even like it's so consistent across all of the different individuals that you can use that as an ID characteristic, where if you see a tree that has a bunch of epiphytes on it, then if it's not a conifer, that's kind of a big thing. Is it a conifer or broadleaf? Is there epiphytes? Big leaf maple.
That's a strong association.
It's really strong. Like it's really, really, really taking it. It's really, really, really striking.
Yeah.
I am not 100% sure. In our episode, we didn't really get to an answer because there is no real answer, but we decided that it's more likely just a bunch of set of circumstances that the tree has essentially steered into and now just has not changed away from it.
Mm.
So most of the time, plants don't want other plants growing on them because those plants will potentially start to decay them. Maybe they will use resources that the plant is actually using, that the tree is using. The epiphyte may use some of those things. It also adds a lot of weight to a plant, where if I'm strong enough to hold up my leaves, as soon as now I'm holding up you and all your leaves,
right,
now everything's a little bit heavier for me. Or maybe you're going to grow and out-compete my leaves by shading out whatever I'm doing.
Moss and lichen famously weigh nothing.
They do. Exactly. There's very little, except on big leaf maples where there's so much of it, it actually starts to add up.
Okay.
In fact, one of the stats we found was something like a significant portion of the biomass, like the weight of living stuff on and of a big leaf maple is not big leaf maple.
Funny.
You know, it's like, how much do you weigh? Okay, now get rid of all the bacteria in your gut and in your hair and all this sort of thing. Then you'll like have a significant reduction in like your biomass.
Yeah.
So the epiphytes on big leaf maple come down to, in my opinion, a few things. One, big leaf maples have a very unique texture of bark, especially as they age. So their bark creates like little micro habitats,
sure,
where there, it's just allowing for that to happen.
Little pockets to cling on to.
Exactly. I also think there's got to be a lack of a some kind of chemical that would keep things away. So like bark of certain trees may be too acidic. It may have too many tannins in it. And it might just not be an appropriate place for plants to really enjoy themselves. For whatever reason. Now, that's a bit of a speculation, so take that, you know, with a grain of salt until someone really looks into it.
That the big leaf maple does not have one of these chemicals?
Yeah, that there's different, that they're that's just one of my postulated ideas.
Okay.
That maybe there's a chemical difference of what is on the bark.
I got you.
So the other thing is that, generally speaking, big leaf maples have big, shady leaves.
Sure.
So they would create a nice, dense shade underneath them. And that is just enough light to keep other things away, but not epiphytes. Not
okay.
These ferns and these mosses and things like that.
And aren't those plants shade tolerant?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. You normally find them growing on, say, the ground.
Sure.
But a lot of these epiphytes are growing wherever there happens to be good things. So licorice fern is a great example of a epiphyte that loves to grow only on the branches of other trees.
Interesting.
So we were like, okay, well, shade, there's shade all over the place. So why isn't this elsewhere?
So far, it's not. It's not a great case.
It's not a great case, but it exists, and no one knows, like, well, why? So the other thing that comes down to it is there are big barks that are vertical on conifers.
Okay.
And as the conifer grows out and gets bigger, that bark slowly gets bigger and thicker. And this is where I think there might be some kind of chemical thing to it, because you don't get big pieces of moss covering the sides of bark of these vertical conifers. Big leaf maples tend to have more of a spreading canopy, where there are certainly stems that grow up or essentially vertical, but they also have branches that come out and arc and then go out to the left and the right and then flatten out, become horizontal, and then you get a lot of branches on there. So they'll have bigger stems that are larger in diameter that are more horizontal than what you'd get for a Douglas fir. Their horizontal branches are usually very small.
I see.
They're long, but their diameter isn't very big. Whereas big leaf maple's diameter would get far larger, far quicker.
It's just a nicer home for something that wants to sit and stay for a while.
Yes. So if you have this unique bark texture that allows a lot of different surface area for things to grow on and collect water, then you now have a flattened horizontal kind of branch coming out that is big diameter. So the bigger in the diameter that it is, the closer to vertical that it technically gets. I'm sorry, the closer to flat it technically gets.
Like more surface area for water to hit.
Exactly. And the flatter that is, so the more water will actually stay there. It's not going to flow away.
Sure.
So then you have this nice habitat. It's in this shaded area, and you start getting these things develop. It also so happens that the big leaf maple will send up adventitious roots into these areas because all these mosses and ferns and epiphytes will start to decay over time. They'll also collect leaf matter. That'll decay.
Yeah.
And it creates this small amount of soil and water collecting material.
Wow.
But the big leaf maples are actually getting nutrients and water from the mosses and the piles of different stuff that's growing on its own branches. So if you peel those off, you'll actually find little hairs, root hairs from the tree.
I've absolutely seen that.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have peeled them off. I was a child.
Oh, that don't even worry about it. The tree's going to be just fine. You could not possibly take away all of their resources.
Sure. I mean, that's like a min-maxing sort of thing.
Yeah,
like, I can increase productivity by 0.01% if I shoot some adventitious roots into this moss.
Exactly. And honestly, you just keep doing it. Now that branch is going to be even stronger. Like it does have this effect. So it could be also that the big leaf maple kind of steered into that and said, great, the one that had the right conditions, whether that's chemical or it just the right kind of habitat requirements and niches for these specific epiphytes, those epiphytes will then give a benefit back to the tree. So the tree has evolved over millions of years to get rid of the defensive things that other trees have, like peeling bark or smooth bark or different chemicals or something like that, that keep the space good for these other plants, because that's ultimately good for the big leaf maple.
Interesting.
So,
hey, you know what? Like Lady Liberty herself said, send me your weary?
Your moss. your small green vascular plants that aren't really vascular plants.
Yep.
I guess I think they're vascular technically.
That's word for word.
Maybe they're not vascular. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Honestly, it's a very rambling statement, Lady Liberty.
It's like Willy Wonka's contract. It just keeps getting smaller and smaller. Thank you, Nathan. Interesting topic.
Interesting topic. Go listen to the Big Leaf Maple episode because we talk a little bit more in depth, and we also present a little bit of research in it, which is really good.
Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. If you have a question for us to answer here on the Mainline Show, join the Patreon, patreon.com/arbitrarypod. We'd be happy to have you. For any amount of money you want to send the podcast to support, there are rewards for you. And of course, our flagship tier, the Cone of the Month Club.
That's right.
Every month you get a cone sticker.
What do we got? What do we got this month, Alex?
It's a great one, Casey. This one's by Leanne Flug, fam of the pod, I would say.
Yeah, 100%.
And this is a ghost pine.
Whoa.
Chilling.
Did it get cold in here?
It even has a little, it has a full moon behind it.
A little spider web.
And it has a little spider living in it.
Love it.
It's just fabulous. If you want to see a picture of it, go to our Instagram at arbitrarypod.
That is right. And while you're there, quickly go into the link tree.
Mm-hmm.
Take a survey.
That's right. Please take that survey if you're willing to. It'll take 2 minutes and it's a great, easy way to help the podcast. That is gum.fm/trees.
Mm-hmm. Or go to Instagram and click on that link tree. It's there too.
Yes. If you happen to be there.
If you happen to be there.
Casey Clapp.
Alex Croson. What a lovely spooky season we're having.
As it always is. Mm-hmm. I love a spooky season. I despise the actual day of Halloween.
Really?
But I love the vibes of October, you know?
Oh, I'm curious what it is about that day.
I think it goes back to when I was a kid. I just didn't like that everybody was wearing masks and I couldn't see anybody.
I see.
And I also associate Halloween with like the smell of like rubber.
Yeah, totally.
Because of the masks I would wear.
Oh, yeah.
And it's sweaty rubber and then like, you know, getting sick off of candy or it's just, it was too spooky for me as a kid. But as an adult, I'm like, I love a little spooky fun.
Yeah, I'll take a little bit of this and that.
I might even watch a horror film tonight.
Ooh, I will be busy.
You're not a horror fan.
I'm not a horror fan at all. No, I find
be careful with that word, by the way.
Frightening.
Yes, sure.
I don't like it. I like Halloween perfectly well.
Yeah.
I don't go out and do the trick-or-treating.
That's the thing. You know? When you're a kid, there's something to do. When you're a college student, there's something to do.
Uh-huh.
And then when you're in your 30s, maybe you don't have like a family yet.
Yeah.
There's not a lot to do.
I guess I do play a Frisbee tournament that is very themed. It's called the Hanford Howl.
Wow. But
that's mostly just Frisbee and party. I don't usually wear a big, intense costume.
Sure.
Unless I'm playing Frisbee, at which point I am, of course, wearing a big, intense costume.
But, your Michelin man outfit.
Yeah, did I just realize, I'm like, I don't really celebrate. And then I realized like, well, for the last like 8 years, I have celebrated both of those things. And the third, man, I am not good at knowing what I do and don't do.
Okay. You do too much. That's why.
Yeah, I guess.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode of our spooky Fortnite. I guess we're going with. We will see you next week for a very spooky episode. Until then, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Completely Arbitrary. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Completely Arbitrary is produced by Alex Croson and Casey Clapp.
Our artwork is by Jillian Barthold, and our music is by Aves and the Mini Vandals.
And you can support the podcast at patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
And find additional readings at completelyarbitrary.com. Thanks for listening.